You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. In her latest book, Werewolves, Dogmen, and Other Shapeshifters Stalking North America, author and investigator Pamela K. Kinney explores the rich tales and history of shapeshifters. From every corner of the Americas come stories of encounters with shapeshifting entities and dog-like creatures. Just what are people seeing? With so many stories, could there be a spark of truth to some of them? But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Thank you to each and every one of you that continues to support me and Mysteries and Monsters through the Patreon. You are greatly appreciated as always. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And don't forget, you can visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for merchandise, episodes and news. Our brilliant intro and outro music is provided by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you to Dean Bestel for his incredible artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Let's join Pamela K. Kinney as we explore the myriad of stories of encounters with shapeshifters. The darkness of night can offer cover to perhaps many things you wish to hide. A glimpse strange figure by the side of a road. A howl in the middle of nowhere awakens you from your sleep. Or perhaps you get a particularly creepy feeling from seeing a hitchhiker thumbing a ride. The continent of North America is dotted with encounters with weird beasts. And in her book, Werewolves, Dogmen, and Other Shapeshifters of North America, author Pamela K. Kinney takes us on a hunt for these terrifying creatures. Pamela, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you for having me.
I think this is probably a topic that I get the most requests about, Pamela, because it's not something I've had a real opportunity to cover in depth. I was fortunate enough to speak with Linda Godfrey a couple of times before she sadly passed us far too soon. And so I've been aware of the rise of this particular phenomenon over the last 30 or 40 years in North America. But obviously, that's built on top of the numerous stories from various tribes and nations, Native Americans, and also the First Nations peoples of Canada and beyond. So you've always seemed to have a love of the strange and the spooky. What saw you sort of drift into this whole hot pot of weirdness, Pamela? Because it's I think this is one of those subjects that until you really scrape the surface, you don't realize how prevalent these creatures are.
Yeah, I kind of always liked werewolves and stuff growing up, besides ghosts. That's why I wrote the ghost story. Well, the ghost stories, I write fiction. That starts with that. Got a chance to write ghost books because one of my editors for that one took over that one, that division for Schiffer. And since then, I wanted to, this pandemic came along, and I love werewolves. I like to watch the movies, even the bad ones that just make me wince in horror, or any shapeshifters. I also like to read them. And I thought, well, you know what? You know, people have been saying, get another ghost book. No, I don't want to do any more ghost books. I want to get into my fiction, but I thought, well, you know, this is the pandemic. I'm not going anywhere. I wasn't going anywhere as a writer. I write at home anyway. And my husband's the only one who's able to still go to work. And I thought, well, besides two novels, I wrote this book. So I ordered a lot of books from Amazon. It was either that or Barnes & Noble, you can get shipped to you.
Mm-hmm.
Or went online and all that stuff and looked for any of my books I had around here that I had for years as a fiction writer to keep on hand for things. And I started writing this, and I really got into depth, I guess, more than I thought. But I thought, I want something out there for people that I want to read. And sometimes this one just really got into me. I wrote all the stuff, wrote down all the stuff, and then I kind of eventually, what like my nonfiction goal books, that's when I put it together. Because fiction, you write it all from beginning to end, and that's how you do it. But nonfiction, you can take them apart and do the chapters and then figure how you want it to look. And then I thought originally maybe Schiffer, but then I thought I kind of talked to my editor at Dreampunk Press, who I met in too, because she's got a couple of my fiction books. And she said, oh, I'll take that. Okay. So she did it. They put it together, got all the mixture of what pictures I have in there are in there, and then got it up there on it through Ingram's, because I thought I wanted it through Ingram's. I wanted it to be where it could be everywhere, not just, you know, in bookstores, online, whatever. And it's been selling really well. I can tell on Amazon. I can tell for royalties, but I can really tell through Amazon. So that's the only one that actually shows you when they're like the top 100 things anywhere else. And it's been staying there since it came out in April 2022 in the top 100, either the Kindle and the paperback. So
fantastic, fantastic. Well, I think having read the book, Pamela, I think that sometimes the problem you can have with certain subjects and certain topics is that people perhaps don't do as much research as you clearly have done in this particular book, because they will focus on certain things and they won't cross-reference things. And sometimes the quality of certain books dealing with weird creatures and cryptids and monsters can sometimes, you think you've seen it already all before, whereas one of the things that really strikes me about your collection is that you've clearly spent, as you refer to there, a lot of time checking everything, and obviously your experience as a as an author, because I think this was about, what, your 10th book, Pamela?
Quite a bit. I have fiction too, but adding it, this would be the 9th nonfiction book. Well, no, not 10th. You're right, 10th. There's actually 11th now, too. I have a story and a true story of an investigation I did for Ghosts locally and another somebody else's Kindle book, but, you know, anthology, but that's it.
I suppose when you start this then, and like I say, because of the clear breadth of research and investigation that you've done with this particular subject, I'm often perplexed that people seem to think, especially in the modern era, that this dog man werewolf is a modern phenomenon, when we can look at, and as you explain in the opening chapters of the book, cultures from all across the world have stories going back to ancient Greece, China, Africa, South America, the Aztecs, Europe. There are stories of dog-headed creatures or weird beasts or shapeshifters that seem to permeate throughout our entire history, regardless of where people lived.
Yes, that's very true.
Does that surprise you? It's one of those things that when I look at it, like dragons and perhaps vampires as well, that regardless of who we are and where we're from, our cultures all seem to have very similar stories, and yet these people would never have met 3,000 years ago, Pamela. So how on earth have we all got these parallel legends?
Good question. I mean, I know that if you think about it, Vikings traveled, Phoenicians traveled, a lot of people traveled too, and I don't know how far they could have even hit the western shores at this point. I mean, the Vikings have. There's been proof of some things they found that Vikings have reached here. But I'm pretty sure that the Native Americans had their own stories anyway to begin with. I mean, Alaska, they had the Kushtika. And actually, if you talk about Native Americans, they all came over the land bridge, which came from Siberia. At one point, there was a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska, that area.
Yeah.
So they all traveled 1,000 years ago. And who's to say all this stuff, I mean, has passed around at some point, a prehistoric man. Now we're finding modern men, Neanderthal, the Denisovans are not the only ones. There's all other versions of humans that we're developing. So who knows what, who communicated at what, but and who knows what started the shape-shifting idea anyway. And considering animals and nature, there's bugs that can change its look by going against something so that it would look like something else to protect itself. who knows where the ideas all came from, but it's interesting. Yeah, I really think it's very, very interesting. And to learn a lot of the, I have Native American in me, I have Sioux blood in me from my father's side, and to, because that's the white buffalo woman in the book too, from that side, but to learn all these different tribes and all the different stories, and they came down and changed the stories. Up Alaska, there was the Kushtika, the otter men, and of course there were wolf men too. I mean, people would see things, and it goes down and changes different ones. The Wendigo, the skinwalkers, which changed to several forms, or evil witches, witchcraft, which actually, if you think about it, in medieval times, witches were burned, so were werewolves that were accused of being werewolves in Europe. And yet we have skinwalkers that can are evil witches. Our witches that are evil witches can take form too. So it's like we're all the same, basically, in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, like you mentioned there, Pamela, you only have to look at nature to see the incredible talent of metamorphosis or camouflage that often is amazing on so many levels. Even if we talk about what you would perceive as something as simple as a caterpillar, and the fact that that can change into a butterfly, and the whole mechanism and what it, that goes through is mind-boggling sometimes, because it essentially dissolves itself and then grows again, which is one of those things that you think, what? How? And so when we look at these kind of stories and legends from the past, I think sometimes it's very easy for people to sort of look down their nose at some of these stories, and often, especially for a lot of indigenous peoples, their cultures and their legends and their stories were often derided and made fun of by the more learned colonists, shall we say, Pamela. So I think, if anything, where we are now, I think we're having a more open and honest conversation with certain cultures in regards to some of these myths that perhaps have been missing in popular culture for over 100, 200 years, perhaps.
Yes, they are. And there are a lot of very interesting stories. I really liked it. I did notice a common thread with the indigenous one that nobody else has noticed. I've heard for years about the skinwalkers. The Navajo have a very real fear of them, the ones that really believe still, and that they won't talk about them or think about them because they'll bring it to them. That was a big common thread, right, with that. Well, I found out the Wendigo had the same one. Kushtika has one, and there's another, if I can pronounce the name, it was a really small little bit I found about it. Wigdog, something like that, all had the same thing, that if they thought about it or heard or spoke about it, that the monster would come to them. So that was an interesting, I actually, I don't know if anybody's ever else noticed that before, but I mentioned that in my book because I wanted to let people know. I said, that's an interesting concept. So the skinwalkers, they probably had to start with going, them coming down from the land bridge from Alaska to into the United, what was the United States back then, territories and stuff, the natives did, and they changed to different tribes, that maybe the Kushtika was probably the first one to have that talk about not talking about it. But it ends up with the at the skinwalkers, and that's a big thing you hear enough and see him. And I found a blog about it saying, oh, we can't talk about it, we can't speak about it, because they're going to come and come after you. So it's not the only indigenous tribe that had that. So that was interesting. I kind of caught.
It's almost, I think it is a very interesting point that sometimes gets overlooked, that there is a very real belief, as if the mere mention, I know even some tribes, Pamela, believe that even thinking about these creatures is enough.
Yeah.
Which shows you the power and the belief system that these peoples have, that they've clearly, it's been ingrained in them for centuries, these creatures and the power that they hold over their culture.
It's not just them. Reading a lot of this stuff for the books I've been through, a lot of the white people that live down in, like where the Navajo live and that, sometimes get nervous about and haven't had encounters when they traveled across the lands to get from one spot to another. The police that, not the Navajo police, the regular police from the white areas or the other areas, would come there, and they've had experiences too. So sometimes I wonder what's truth and what's reality. I don't know at this point, but there are people who've had experiences, so.
I suppose as well, one of the most difficult parts of pulling a book together like this is, especially in this day and age with the internet as it is, Pamela, and so many channels passing on experiences and stories, that I suppose you have to sort of try and untangle the popular culture version of these particular creatures and the actual cultural stories behind them, because it's very interesting how they seem to have become mixed up over the last 50 years, and a lot of things that first made their appearance in films seems to have cross-pollinated into the mythos of these creatures, which is a bit strange. So did you come across, when you were looking into certain creatures and the belief systems, did you see any sort of trends of how things have developed in regards to, you know, like people believe that you have to be bitten or you need silver bullets and things like that?
Yeah, the bitten thing probably was more the movies at this point. Going back to as far as medieval times, I remember as a kid, this is for me, I remember as a kid getting this book, and there was a thing in it that they found on a medieval manuscript of how to turn into a werewolf. And it's just a wolf skid belt and uttering some words underneath the full moon. So that might be where the full moon idea came from. That's just something that they had to do to turn. And so over the years, I mean, even among the tribes, the way that one's out here do it, they don't all change the same anyway. And skinwalkers, gosh, I keep seeing them saying like, oh, they're werewolves. No, they don't just turn into wolves. They turn into coyotes, wolves, eagles, different human shapes sometimes. They don't just turn into one thing. They are, that's because they're witches. They can do different forms. Yeah, a lot of that can get misconstrued by Hollywood and people writing novels. I understand novels. I'm a writer, fiction too, but the movies really construed a lot. I think people watch more movies and do gaming and to get the ideas from werewolves and stuff like that from that. So skinwalkers, people say, oh, that's a skinwalker. No, that's a witch. Skinwalkers can take more than one shape. Werewolves just take the one shape. So <Yeah. laughs> that movies have done a lot to do things and what people believe.
Yeah. I think you can tell a lot about a person's level of research if they just presume skinwalkers are wolves, Pamela, because I think that just shows that they've either just read something or seen something, because even with my limited knowledge, even though it is growing consistently, because I'm trying my best to learn as much as I can about Native American legends and myths, that even I know that the skinwalker can take the shape of anything he wishes to be. You know, he just needs the pelts, and for some reason it's the wolf version that seems to have caught the zeitgeist and disappeared, and all the others seem to be like, hang on a minute, we're all shapeshifters here.
Yeah,
I think as well that you start the book with a wonderful quote, which is, there is a beast in man that needs to be exercised, not exercised, by Antony Lefay, which I think is one of those things, because this kind of duality in humans has been with us since time began, it would seem, Pamela, and this is quite clear in your book as well. I suppose when you were pulling it together and deciding how to start, were you surprised to come across so many stories as close to you? Because I think most people, when they think about dogmen or werewolves or shapeshifters, have specific areas. But then you've got the loup-garou in Louisiana and the states down south. And then you've also got other aspects of certain other pockets around the US. Were you surprised to see as many stories closer to where you're based than you perhaps were aware of?
Well, I knew about werewolf and Henrico. I coined the term. I know that Linda Godfrey wrote a book, and I got that book when I ordered books, Werewolves of America, and I laughed because that I was the first to coin it. There's a forum online here for things happening in the sections of Henrico near me. I live in Chesterfield County. It's kind of like a split between that, and then there's Richmond and there's Henrico. Henrico is the west, what they call the West End, and there were a couple of areas where something people had seen, something like wolf-like creatures, either white or different, or in the area, and had experiences. So I kind of realized, I was writing at the time Haunted Richmond, well, Haunted Virginia, Legend of Truth, and later it became part of Haunted Richmond too, because I went back into that forum, because nobody's wrote about it. So I said, well, I'm going to call this the Werewolf and Henrico. I mean, why not? I mean, Linda Groffrey, Beast of Brave World, why not? It's nothing abnormal, but it is in Henrico County only. So, it's so close to here. So I knew about it, and that's very current. There's still stuff going on. Some people say it's Bigfoot, but people have seen something dog-like or on four legs or on hind legs. So at this point, I don't know. I wouldn't say that was Bigfoot if it's supposed to be an ape. But the one I found lately for this book was, because I had done a Surrey to Suffolk book, was the Dismal Swamp Werewolf stories from the 1800s. And I came across that somehow mysteriously online, that I didn't find it before, but I went through looking up on it and everything like that, and there it happened in the 1800s, and I'm assuming not in the swamp per se, but probably the homes along the side of the swamp, because the swamp right now is a really big park, and there's homes outside and farms around it, and they had experiences from this creature. So that was kind of new. But yeah, there were others too. I was surprised even earlier in my, way before all this, the story of the werewolf up in Stone Gap of Virginia and stuff like that. So there's a lot of that around there. But to find that it wasn't just, everybody thinks dogmen, for example, or I'm going to call them wolfmen. Now that they say dogs really are wolves, and I always believed that they were, they weren't just a separate canine, that that's from scientists, that it's all over. It's not just Wisconsin where the Beast of Bray Road is, or Michigan, that it's actually all over, and that it's all over the world finding these stories about, like, the dog-headed men in the Greek island that was in the myth, in the mythology and stuff like that. It's been around for all over. So wolf-type creatures, or what they probably thought was dogs at the time, but the wolves is what people keep saying a lot of. You know, they've seen other shapeshifters, but these are pretty prevalent, the wolf-like. So that was kind of interesting to realize it's not just in one area. It's not in the Midwest. It's out in the East Coast. It's out in California. It's out in Washington. It's up in Alaska. It's in a cat everywhere. So somebody seen kind of some sort of wolf creature with a body of a man walking on its hind legs or on all four for a long, long time. So
I mean, I have seen some very strange attempts at explaining certain wolfman or dogman sightings, Pamela, over the years. The most popular theme seems to be that people have mistakenly seen a baboon. But as far as I'm aware, I'm not really sure that baboons are native to North America.
No. Well, they had stories in your own in England too of dog or werewolves or something. Several places over there. So I've seen that on shows and in books. So it's prevalent everywhere at some point. So
yeah. Friend of mine, Paul C. Clare, has just done a documentary called Wolflands, which is exactly about a series of people's encounters and sightings in the east of Yorkshire, which isn't too far from where I live now, Pamela. So it is remarkable. I think what strikes me about the werewolf of Henrico from the chapter that you mentioned this is that I'm not aware of any other dog wolf type creature of this nature that's pure white. Is this unique to the Henrico case, or are there other creatures that aren't the normal sort of black, grey, shaggy brown that we would normally perceive a wolf to look like?
Well, real wolves could be white. I mean, the timber wolves have white, black, and all different colors. It's not gray timber, as people think. But thinking about all the stories, it's a lot of dogman ones. I would have to almost go through my book again. Mostly, I think they were either seen black or brown-haired, maybe some red, but that's about it. But I think that's the only one I've seen that was white. Kind of reminded me of the Harry Potter movie where the dog guy turned into that werewolf was like a skinny old, looked more like a white, big white dog. And the guy that could turn into the dog looked more like what you would think of as a werewolf. I said that's why I pointed that out. I said, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of looks like the Harry Potter guy that turned into that werewolf, but it was a big old white thing like that. So that's what the description reminded me of in that one. So
what's always struck me about this is often people will explain people's experiences away as, oh, they've just seen a scary film recently, or they've misidentified something. And yet the werewolf as a film subject's been around with us for 110 years. The first werewolf film was released in 1913, which was originally a very, very originally titled The Werewolf. And sadly, it was destroyed in a fire in 1924. So we've no idea what it looked like or anything. I'm very interested in this period of sort of the 1910s. There were three werewolf films, that two of whom were from the same guy whose name escapes me at the moment, but they were both based on Native American shape-shifting legends. There was a lot of sort of kind of creating some kind of soup from pulling bits of legend and myth together to create a very interesting story, which I find quite surprising. That obviously these films, everybody who was in it, despite the fact that they were supposed to be playing Native Americans, they were all white, which is unsurprising for that particular period of time. But I find it odd that people will try and explain it away these days, when perhaps the werewolf isn't as trendy in films as it used to be. You see the odd good one pop up every now and again. Whereas when you look at the culture, you would expect sightings to suddenly start in the 1940s or the 1950s, Pamela, when the films were massive, when Lon Chaney Jr. was the Wolfman and it was a big hit at the box office, not in the late 80s where werewolf films had kind of dribbled out really towards the end of that decade.
And that they look actually more like a werewolf with the head of a wolf and a body of a man. You hear the description of which, yeah, if it was a werewolf, I don't know, for say someone's shapeshift. Number one, we're apes, so I can imagine if you watch the movies that do it well, where they show the pain of shape, because let's be honest, our bones would have to really shift differently to a canine body comparably to from an ape body or feet or anything else. That they have described them with pointed ears above and all that, because the Wolfman in the 40s, that which was a good film, but he was actually, I think he looked more like a cave person, if he became a cave person again or something else, more of that type, except he had more of a maybe of a slight muzzle. But I would say it's been seen for a long time, and a lot of descriptions, at least the Dismal Swamp one, kind of sounded more like a wolf-like creature on its hind legs. Which is interesting. That's why they were freaked out in that area by seeing this in the 1800s. And I would assume, I don't know, I mean, there's been drawings back then, if they had, people did that, but I doubt it. At least in the area of Dismal Swamp, it was probably more country for them to have that kind of experience. But who's to say? I don't know. All I know is that the dogmen have descriptions of more like it. They say a short muzzle, they call it a dog, but considering that the wolf, the timber wolf in my book picture is from a zoo here. It's the same exact long snout as my, I used to have a Siberian husky.
Yes.
The wolf, and looked like a wolf. He was papered, but he had the same length of snout, so I don't but verify that it's because it's got a short snout. And but they have everything else description like a wolf head with the pointed ears up and all that. So I don't know. Be interesting. I kind of hope if anything's possible, it's the dog man or the wolf man. That I would love to see.
Actually, from a safe distance.
It would just be interesting to see it. I mean, really.
Well, yes, absolutely. I think this is one of those things, and I remember speaking with Ken Gerhardt about this particular subject once, and we were discussing what is the difference between a werewolf and a dogman? Because I think this is the thing, because when you talk about this particular subject, some people get very precious about particular terms, Pamela, and so as we've just been discussing there, the werewolf in literature and cinema is a human being for a variety of reasons that ends up being able to transform into a wolf-like creature. Whereas the Dogman seems to be more, as we've saying, more human-shaped, but with a dog's head. And yet, nobody's ever seen either of these creatures transform, so I'm perplexed as to how you can differentiate between what's a werewolf and what's a dog man or a wolf man, because I think if you see it transform, you're probably not going to be around to tell us about it.
No. And probably know what we're seeing, maybe it's been seen for centuries and people just thought it was a werewolf because they thought it was some evil human. I mean, people can make up stories about animals that they don't know about, especially in the old times where they weren't as well intelligently enough with science and everything to figure things out. The Dogman, we have no proof it can transform because people, when they encounter it, it's already looking what it looks like. And they don't see it disappear or anything like that. I mean, if as a writer with my imagination, and would be interesting considering I also have read science fiction and group of science and stuff like that. What about other dimensions? What if it's some from something else from another dimension? And that's the way that being formed comparably here, we came off from apes. I mean, that's an idea. And I think I've seen things like that where people have approached that were sort of, you know, so we don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting to find out. It's just kind of strange that people have seen this all over, just like they've seen Bigfoot. You think, oh, Bigfoot's only here in America or someplace like that. But then you hear you hear stories in Cambodia and all sorts of places all over the world. They just got different names for it. Yeti, it's got a different name. It's not even white. It's actually browner. The Yeti is brown or black, just like our Bigfoot. So that's all it is. I mean, who's to know what's true and how it got all over the world? Because I don't think everybody watches TV or watches all the movies to get that idea. So it kind of makes you wonder, you know.
Well, I think often the problem with this particular topic is that people do try and explain what they are or where they've come from. I think sometimes, Pamela, as you say there, I've seen people claim that they're coming in from an alternative dimension. I've seen people claim that there are werewolves, it's witchcraft, it's sinful behavior, it's genetic, it's aliens. Ironically enough, on an episode I've recently done, one of the encounters in that featured a couple of children who claimed that they were being visited by a werewolf from a spaceship, which is a very strange UFO story at the best of times. It's an odd story, regardless of the fact that the children say that they encountered some kind of werewolf-type creature. So I suppose when you have a body of work like this, Pamela, you find numerous explanations or attempts at trying to solve this mystery, when I think the very fact that we have these reports and these stories so ingrained from around the world shows that these have been with us for so long that modern explanations probably don't fit it anyway.
That's right. It's still good to kind of think and wonder. Yeah. But it's a wonder if we have these, and we have these mythologies, if we have these stories, and maybe they aren't mythologies, but whatever they are, they're really, really, really good. And I really, when I wrote this, I was hoping that a lot of people would learn a lot from this, because there's a lot of good stories out there among the indigenous peoples that we can learn here in the United States as it is. So, and they're fascinating.
Yes, and I think it gives you a real insight into an area's culture and its history as well, because some of these stories, they're about similar creatures, but the way they interact or they behave or how they live amongst us can be quite strikingly different, can't they? Do you think that just says more about a certain culture's acceptance of this reality, Pamela? Or do you think that perhaps some people are just a bit tougher than others and they know how to get along with strange creatures?
I just think they've had it long enough to handle it. I mean, they would talk about, you hear stories, reading about Bigfoot, that it's been, here in Virginia, the oldest sightings has a Bigfoot has been Virginia. I've discovered that. I want to start a Bigfoot con selling there, and I asked a Bigfoot guy who does all this, you know, for they call them hunters, right? I said, did you know that the oldest sightings is here in Virginia? He didn't know that. I found that out. I said, well, we have the oldest sightings, and it would be logical that we would have that, because the indigenous tribes and the oldest sightings would be probably after that the English, because obviously in California the Spanish didn't encounter it, at least not before we did. So the oldest sighting, Bigfoot, they consider them, a lot of them consider them spirits, so whatever they, you know, in some tribes. And they seem to have a good coexistence with a lot of them, so, and their beliefs. So it's like I said, really good stories, and learn to maybe acceptance of what someone's different. It doesn't mean that you have to dislike them or fear them.
I mean, when you were uncovering some of these stories, did you find any of the beliefs of people believing that these creatures were spiritual, Pamela, or was the overriding realization of these creatures in certain places that they were flesh and blood, or did you find a good mix of that particular belief?
Well, the skinwalkers or witches, they use evil to you know, killing and stuff to become these, and then they have to have shamans there who use their own spiritual ways of being good to combat some of these sometimes. So some of that, like that Wendigo, I don't know if that's spiritual as much as I know they believe it's a creature in the beginning. I have the stories in there of what it really essentially looks like if you call it Wendigo with the deer horns and the whole thing, comparably to the true story of the guy that said he found out he killed his wife and kids and ate them, and it was arrested and put in jail already for all that stuff, that they would use a term for that wintertime meant to fear it and be prepared, because if you don't have food and stuff to prepare, when winter hits, you'll be starving, and the Wendigo will take you over, and you're going to want to eat somebody, your family and that. So they're all different. The Tekushtika, I guess it's sort of a spirit, because I don't think any otter I ever met is 8 to 9 foot tall. Atlanta otter. So, and it's supposedly that it's only the men and boys have to fear it up there, because that's what they're looking for. And they try to lure the, like, boys a whistle or call out, and they'll get them, lure them to them, and they'll capture them, and they'll keep them until they start changing themselves into a Kushtika. So some things are spiritual, and it's just mostly, I think, a lot of, some of it's reality probably, and what they believe, but at this point, look, a lot of it looks more spiritual and how they change it, whether it's good or evil, and is the difference right out there.
I suppose another explanation that people put forward about some of these stories from around the world, Pamela, is hypertrichosis as an explanation, that people were seeing others in their communities or that had been shunned because they suffer from this terrible ailment where their body just grows hair everywhere and they can't control it. But it is such a rare condition. Even today, I think there's less than 100 cases ever recorded, that I find the explanation that everybody was seeing somebody who suffered from hypertrichosis extremely dubious at best. Did you see anybody try and suggest such an explanation for some of these cultures, or is it just one of those things that, yeah, people put it forward as an explanation, but when you scrutinize it, it simply doesn't stand up?
It's just one explanation. There is, by science, that there is people like that. And I can imagine if they're in the wrong culture, that probably affects them more, especially if the culture doesn't understand why this person keeps having a lot of hair and stuff. Another thing, too, is the real science-based fact of people that mentally think they're become werewolves. Yes. They don't change. It's where the lycanthropy term came from. But there is people that do that, too. And I think there's even been a serial killer, if I remember right, in history, that way, way back, that youth probably was probably more likely like that, thinking he was a werewolf. And that's why, you know, he was killing people and eating them. But yeah, so that is that psychosis. But of course, they don't change. I mean, they look like us. They just mentally lost it, and they see themselves as a werewolf. So.
Yeah, because lycanthropy can really affect people, like you say, and they believe, because they've been studied, and even when they're allegedly going through the change, Pamela, it's notable that when they're being assessed by psychiatrists and doctors, they believe that they've changed, they've transformed, whereas everybody with them can see that it's still the same person. It's the behaviour that's changed. And it's remarkable, like you say, because it's something that's been with us, as we can say, you know, it comes from ancient Greek, I believe, lycanthropy. So it's incredible that that is still with us. And it just shows you sometimes the strangeness of the world, that we have such forms of mental illness that cause people to go through this incredible suffering, as you say, because I would imagine, as we were discussing earlier about the transformation from a human form to that of a dog type canid, that there would be some kind of breaking and stretching and pulling and all kinds of uncomfortable things. So it's notable in the cases that I've read about for people that suffer from this disorder, that they do feel like they are in massive amounts of pain until the change has gone off, which just shows you the power of the mind.
Because, yeah, you're right. There is no the power of the mind. Because like you said, like I said, explain, for us to change for real, like you see in a real good werewolf movie where you see like American Werewolf where he's changing and he's crying. And he's, yeah, we're splitting. We're changing our bodies from one shape animal to another animal. So that's, we're not, I mean, look at our feet. We have 8 feet. We don't have dog feet. I mean, I've seen, I have dogs. I've had cats. So I know the difference in the feet. So kind of makes you think in a reality. You have to go through all that mentally to become aware, thinking you're a werewolf. And so there are those people that go through that. I don't know if we have that many today, I've heard of, but there are people like that. And that's kind of there. I mean, maybe a good reason for a lot of serial killers that in the past have killed and then ate people too. So,
Well, nothing would surprise me, I'm afraid, these days, with some of the characters that have passed through the penal system in regards to serial killers, that some of them would no doubt believe them to be possessed by certain creatures of the night. Perhaps, Pamela, I would be more surprised if they weren't, to be honest, a few characters like that.
Oh, yeah. There are people that believe they're vampires for real.
Mm.
There's a book I found one day. They actually do that. And that's, they don't hurt anybody, but they actually believe they're vampires. They do drink blood, so. I won't, but that's okay.
I mean, there's one story that I'm intrigued by, because it would make a brilliant film or a short play, which is the Guardian or the Wolf of Witch Cottage, I think it is, which seems to be a group of kids who find some abandoned cottage in the woods somewhere and decide to sort of help themselves to a few things, who end up encountering some kind of strange wolf creature. And I'm very interested in the numerous stories that you've got that seems to connect, probably more than any other sort of paranormal entity, the witch and the werewolf, Pamela. Did you see that duality in this? Or was that something that didn't surprise you because, as we've mentioned, you have certain cultures where this belief that witches can transform into different things quite prevalent in say, Mexico and other such places?
Oh, they have the skinwalkers. That's what they are. They're witches. People got to misinterpret that. Like I said, they're werewolves. They're not. They're witches. The owl witches with the tribe that have the belief in the owl witches, they could transform into witch, owls, and they were carnivorous. So that was the whole thing about that. Of course, in our own in Europe, in the times when they were burning the witches, because they say they were witches, well, they burned werewolves too, because witches were believed that they can transform same as werewolves, so they can change into something else. So the werewolves might be witches. And there has been, I think, one that transformed into a bird here in our times, Connecticut, colonial times, New England area. And there's been others that have done that, too. So, yeah, there's belief that a lot of times they're interconnected a lot, too. I mean, even, I guess, shamans, if you hear stories, that they believe that they could take over or enter the mind of an animal and fly.
Mm-hmm.
In Africa, when the tribes, the chiefs died, they believed they transferred their souls into the bodies of lions. So that's kind of a form of shape-shifting, I guess, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Their souls are going into the lion instead of...
Yeah. I mean, that's something that seems to have sort of been repackaged into sort of modern fantasy as well. You will often see fantasy stories or films, Pamela, where a witch or a warlock will be able to use the power of eagle sight or things like that. And it just shows you that even if they're not talking about transforming, they are showing clear connection between man and beast for a variety of reasons. So it's not a great leap to go from that kind of belief to move from control to metamorphosis, is it?
No. And actually, it's been in movies. Cat People was one of them.
Mm.
I watched both, but the second one definitely shows them where supposedly, and there's no way, I hate to say it, that a leopard can mate with a human, but black leopard, but that's okay. But it ended up that you find out that they can transform, and then I guess they had to mate with, of course, a human because they weren't really leopards.
Mm. Well, yes, I know there's a couple of werewolf films from the past where our poor victim ends up developing this ailment due to the fact that they've had a blood transfusion of wolf blood, which I think is one of those things you could get away with 100 years ago. Now we just go, well, that'll kill you. It won't do anything.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Putting anybody's blood in, if you don't know what blood type they are,
yes,
they probably do things to you that wouldn't be good either. They didn't know back then either, I'm sure.
Absolutely, yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes, be careful. Be careful how you try to transform, I think, is the moral of that story, Pamela. I mean, one of the great things as well, there are some stories here. I mean, this is the thing that often gets my goat about this particular subject, is that people go, oh, well, until the Beast of Bray Road, there was no such thing as dogmen or werewolf stories in North America. I know Linda Godfrey uncovered a lot. You've got loads. Do you think, as with Bigfoot stories, where people completely ignore everything before 1958 for some reason, as though the evidence isn't there that we can find these stories, that they just presume that these are just modern myths that people are getting overexcited for, and yet you've got stories going back, you know, to the 19th century, the early part of the 20th century, from all over the US and Canada. Do you think that this is one of those subjects that people just didn't publish them, or that they've always, as we've said, these encounters and stories have always been with us, and it's only in the last 35 years that they've finally been published and put forward properly rather than being dismissed or ignored?
I think a lot of people just ignore, or they thought, oh, they're probably from an area or from a town that's, they're not that well educated or something like that. They're going to believe in that sort of, I can imagine that's how it went. And eventually when people left and their kids went to college maybe, or went to school finally and came back, so I don't believe in that. And things, or the, whatever happened, like Dismal Swamp, eventually, whatever it was, it went away. It, where it went to, or maybe it just went deeper into the swamp itself to hide from people. They didn't have any more experiences, so that was it. And eventually, and two, you know, you find there's a collection somewhere people kept of legends and stuff and like that. There's actually a big, talk about Dismal Swamp, there's a big giant I found when I did Surrey to Suffolk, because that's why Dismal Swamp, Dismal Swamp werewolf's not in it, but everything else is.
Mm.
I found a lot of legends that are connected to that swamp. So somebody actually went through and dug them all up to find them and stuff. So I thank him for that. That helped a lot with Surrey to Suffolk. The Dismal Swamp is why it has a lot of hauntings, but it also has a lot of all sorts of interesting, weird tales and stuff. Besides the Bigfoot stories, of course, too, was connected to that. But yeah, they're until someone writes it down somewhere, or someone maybe did write it down and someone finds the information and then they start writing a book and putting out. It's kind of interesting. We're getting more and more of that now. A lot of good mythologies and stuff that are out there. Somebody just saw it, and I bought the book. I'm waiting for it. I think it came today. It's coming today from Amazon. It wrote a book about all the Christmas legends and stuff. Mm. You know, people think Christmas is, oh, it's a good time of year. It's no more scary stuff. No, actually, Christmas, I discovered when I did a blog years ago, is far more scarier time in history than it was Halloween, that the Victorians told ghost stories right then instead of, yep, you know, Christmas Eve. What are you talking around there? Are you going to talk a nice Santa story? No, they're talking ghost stories. There's Krampus. You got all sorts of Yule Cat. They're all over the world, all this stuff. So, and he wrote a book, so I want to see what he's got in there, all that stuff, because there's a lot of interesting stuff. But until now, they're coming back in style. There's coming out in a couple of weeks. I won't be able to do it because I have another interview at night. They have what they call a Krampus walk, and people make the mask and everything, and they wear the Krampus look, and some of them look really good in the pictures you see. Mm. And they do a Krampus walk on December 3rd at night. And so that's become pretty, you know, back in style again.
Yeah. 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 We've got a really big one here in Whitby, which is obviously the home of where Dracula was supposed to have landed. And they have a phenomenal Krampus festival there, and like you say, some of the costumes and the work that goes into creating these wonderful costumes is just jaw-dropping, the work that and time that these people spend to create these wonderful creatures. And it is remarkable how quickly over the last 20 years or so that Krampus has kind of come back and is now the cool, horrible messenger. But it's you know, at the end of the day, it's kind of changing that, because Krampus has always been there. He's just kind of been ignored for a very long time as Santa's Santa's heavy, would you say?
Well, you know, they used to change it to, you if you were bad, you got coal in your stocking.
Yes,
which I don't know, why would you get coal in your stocking with these people? You could just throw that in the dirt somewhere outside. But there was Krampus before the coal. I said, he makes the coal look like nothing. You wish you had that coal back. So I tell people, says, if you thought Christmas was all about happiness and, oh no, there's a lot of good stories all over the world. It's not as unscary as you think it is. That's why they had that song. Someone pointed it out. Told scary ghost stories. Why would that be in that Christmas song? And they actually did it.
Well, as with anything, if you wait long enough, something usually comes back into fashion. And it's the same, as you say, with Krampus, and as you refer to there about scary stories at Christmas. It was something that was very traditional here in the UK that kind of dropped out of fashion by the mid-70s. And it's now, over the last 10 years or so, Pamela, here, back in style again. We have a new scary Christmas story every year on the BBC.
And someone told me last year, and did a book sign, a friend of mine who's a writer, she's well, werewolves and dog men are in style. I said, I didn't know if I hit the style at the time, but yeah, they're back in style. So, I mean, I know a couple of local big ghost hunters. Some, they do dog men hunting too now. So it's the new thing. I mean, people are realizing there's other things out there, you know.
Mm. Did you come across lots of, because I've seen this as well, that people say that there's often a correlation between Bigfoot hotspots and dogman hotspots or man-wolf hotspots. Have you found that when you were doing your book, having a look and saying, do you get a concentration of strange creature sightings wherever they are? Or, as I've also seen people try and explain, as though they know these things, that the dogman and the Bigfoot keep out of each other's patches.
Some say that they're the same thing, that there's a Bigfoot with a snout, but I don't know if I believe that. If you're going to look like an ape, you're going to look like an ape. Mm. There is a difference between our mouse and a dog's or wolves. Mm. But I think they're in basically what I come across, sometimes the same areas, basically. Sometimes, I mean, you hear that. So, I don't know. Are they scared of each other? No. Are they hate each other? No. I guess we haven't heard any stories about werewolf and dogmen and Bigfoot having a battle, like, you know, like in a movie. So, obviously not. But they're in this. Sometimes the same areas, basically. It's not that far off, especially if there's woods or mountains to be in. To hide in, that would be basically, I would assume. Now, Bigfoot's territorial sometimes to us, but I guess we can cause a lot of territory with that. But I assume I haven't come across anything different. Something seemed like they're the same areas, basically.
Hmm. Well, yeah, usually if somewhere's quite remote, you would imagine anything would like to live there because it's not going to be bothered by people, Pamela.
No.
I suppose, well, I would imagine, I would suggest that if you look hard enough, I'm sure there's somebody out there who's got a story of a dogman and a Bigfoot having a fight and they've seen it. So as long as a Wendigo didn't turn up, I suppose that everybody's okay in that, because who knows what would have happened. I think one of the other aspects of this is that you've also got these other strange creatures that seem to appear all over North America, where you've got things like the Wampus Cat or the Shunkawadakan, Pamela. Did you see any of that? Because I'm very I find it intriguing that the Shunkawadakan is obviously this alleged hyena-like dog creature that terrorized a particular area, and there's all this whole backstory about what happened after it was killed and everything. But people think that's flesh and blood, whereas I've noticed that the Wampus Cat, some people believe that that is a shapeshifter of some description.
Well, it's shapeshifting in a point, I mean, in the original Native American legend. And that's more southern around this area, I gather. I'm not from here originally. I'm from Mountain West California, but it's a pretty big thing out here. North Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, that sort of area. The Wampus Cat especially starts with the Native American. That's where it came from first. And supposedly she was looking at a young maiden to see what her husband and his men were, his fellow others and the chief were doing. When the women had stayed back in the village, right? And she got caught, and she was changed into a half mountain lion, half woman purse thing. So they called the Wampus Cat. And that's supposedly believed in by a lot of Southerners still. You'll see stories maybe out in the country more where they think Wampus Cat came and did something to their cattle or something like that. So, it has to shift. Obviously, she's shifting if she's been changed, whether by magic or whatever. And I think it was a magic curse or something because she did that. So it's like a mountain lion, but it's like halfway or something. So to me, that's still a shifting of shapes because she's no longer the woman, or they're no longer the woman. They're now a half mountain lion, half human. So, and that's a lot of, so far, at least it started from Native American mythology. But it carries on with a lot of the southern areas, some of the more countrified areas. About cattle or something, they think a Wampus Cat did it and all that stuff.
I had to smile when I got to the section of the book that talks about dogmen, because I like how someone's taken the time, Pamela, to do a classification of these creatures.
And yeah, there's people that have done it. They've done it with Bigfoot too, so you'd be surprised.
Yeah. I suppose when you're crafting a book like this, Pamela, you very quickly learn not to be surprised by some of the things you discover, but it's perplexing that there seems to be such a variation in what people are saying, which I suppose, as we were saying earlier, people would say, oh well, it's misdescription, or it's people saying the wrong things. I've seen both people who believe in dogmen and people who believe in Bigfoot try and explain the other's sightings away as misidentification of a different creature. But like we've said here, you're talking about something with a muzzle against something that's flat-faced. I find it very hard that you could misplace or missee something like that.
That's what people do, though. They do that with werewolf and Horaco. Some are saying, oh, it's Bigfoot. Well, really, yet somebody saw something that didn't look like a Bigfoot. So I don't know. I mean, that's what people do. And I get it. Might as well put it all in, because that's what they did. They make classifications. Some will do that. They're dogman hunters, so they're going to classify. They're Bigfoot hunters, so they're going to classification. So they're out there, and you put this down, you know, because you figure everybody's going to want to see this. And I wrote this intentionally originally, not only for myself, but for writers that would do all this horror fiction and stuff. And to get the classifications might give them ideas and stuff like that. it's interesting that, of course, it went into a lot of readers are reading it, which I'm happy they are. I mean, it's selling. But yeah, that's nothing shocking to me. I've seen all sorts of stuff, so.
Have you uncovered many stories similar to the one? This one made me chuckle because I was thinking, how on earth can you misidentify this? Which is this group of teenagers who are desperate to adopt a puppy in Milwaukee. And on their way home from the local humane shelter, they see a little, what they think is a puppy, sat by the side of the road. And then all of a sudden it stands up, it's 7 feet tall, and it runs off.
Yeah, awfully big for a puppy, too.
Yes. Puppy. I think, what was it? What they, did they think it was a St. Bernard? I don't know.
Well, you know, people wouldn't know. A lot of times, bishops of Groton City don't even know what's probably a wolf is. They might think it's a dog, you know, and, oh, here's a puppy dog. It's a wolf cub, maybe, you know, wolf pup. But, you know, that people don't know. They just see that. At least that's what they claim. I don't know. These are, I'm putting down whatever people claim. So, but yeah, for it to get that, I thought that was weird. I thought, well, it's a puppy. They grow. There's the biggest dog is, and it's still standing up. Wouldn't be 7 foot like that. You know, it'd still be a pup comparably to a full grown dog. But which is the biggest one? What wolf dog? The Russian wolfhounds are big.
Yeah.
They're 6 foot.
Yeah.
When they stand up. But that's a full-grown dog.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think you would... I mean, but once again, none of these breeds get up on their hind legs and run off, Pamela. They, you know, they'll bound away on four legs.
Dogs cannot run for long. There is no way. They can do only so long, and they don't actually... When you watch in a circus, train dogs in a circus act that I've seen... They don't walk very long. They mostly eventually a little bit and then they flop down or they hop.
Yeah.
There's only so long they can do it. They're not made. Their spine is not made. Not even apes. We're about the only ones that can walk long enough because we eventually, our ancestors went through and changes. Even chimpanzees only can walk so long and you see how they walk to balance. So, yeah, I don't see how a dog would be able to walk in a time. That's why I said when you see them, when you see something as a dog, it looks like a wolf or a dog, and it gets a big one, it gets up on its hind legs and walks off, that's when you start worrying.
Yeah, it is noticeable, like you say there, that if you see a dog performing tricks or standing up, they don't walk. It seems a real struggle. Yes, you go, oh, brilliant, look at this dog, it's on its hind legs. But it's not walking. Like you say, it's either hopping or it's shuffling. It doesn't walk in a stride, does it?
No, and some of the circus acts, they have them pushing a carriage, but it's holding onto a carriage and it still isn't walking quite like I think it would if it was normal. Its spine's probably feeling that too at that point.
Mm. Well, I think anybody that owns a dog, Pamela, is fully aware of a dog's ability to stand on its hind legs, especially if you're preparing food. Especially in my house, certainly. I mean, when you look back at this, would you say that when you started the book, you were of a certain mind, and when you finished the book, your opinions or your perceptions of this particular phenomenon have changed, Palmer, or as someone who has an open mind to the paranormal and the spooky, was already kind of enticed into this?
Fine. I would like to see a word. I believe in ghosts because I investigate and I can tell you stories. And I've changed people. I have a filmmaker that films me now when we investigate. He used to never, he can tell you how you can fake everything in the movies. So I did things that changed his mind about the reality of it. So I don't try to hide what I do. And of course, I'm not trying to make money off of it or anything like that. But I'd like to be interested. It'd be kind of cool to see something like a dogman, wolfman, what do you want to call it? I'm not sure about a Bigfoot. That kind of freaks me. I keep thinking like I remember a big giant gorilla, and I know when it stood up in a zoo in San Diego where I grew up, and it was had a rocking hat up and down like it was looking for somebody. It must have teased it. I'm thinking, no, I don't want an ape ever after me, and I really don't want to see a 9 foot Law and Order either. There's something that's cute and cuddly on its hind legs coming at me. There's something that big. There's something wrong here, and I should be taken off, not arc- going, oh, wow.
Yes, I think any meat-eating mammal is okay until it gets to a certain size, Pamela. And then all bets are off.
And I can believe, because you hear stories enough about some types of magic can really, especially bad magic, can be worked. And I do really think a lot of these tribes do probably have, should be smart of us to understand that they're warning us. It's not nice to know this stuff, like skinwalkers. I mean, it's the same thing like in Africa, Haitian voodoo. There's been stuff that's been proven it can really work, and it's actually using a pufferfish anyway.
Yeah.
That can make you go unconscious, probably like you're dead. So who's to say what could have been done by skinwalkers if they know how to, for centuries doing stuff. So I do believe in some of that stuff, and but I also hope there's a be nice to see a dogman. If I did, I'll make sure to, I always have my camera and my phone with me. I'll take a good picture. In the nighttime, I have night vision. I can do that. So,
All right.
And I won't upset it, of course, either. If it wants to carry a deer off, it can have the deer. I'm not going to let it tell it. Yeah. I don't want to hurt it.
Yeah.
Don't want to hurt me either.
Yeah, there does seem to be a lot of stories about people encountering these human-like canines carrying deer about as well, which is, I'm always... You know, and you touched on it earlier on that, you know, some people go, oh, well, these people don't know anything. They're uneducated. They're just simple people. But I find it ridiculous to suggest that professional hunters or people that have been out there for 40, 50 years in the woods, Pamela, can't recognize animals from distance, because I think that's what their job is. So I find it incredible that, once again, they're often they're just simple people who hunt. And I find that ridiculous, because often these people know so much about certain animals because they have to know about behavior and their movements and how they live and how they travel to enable them to do what they do. So I find it ridiculous to suggest that these people don't know what they're talking about when they clearly know more than the person probably telling them that they don't.
And if they're seeing it, they're probably most likely seeing something that's off the wall. It's the same thing with anything like that. Here in Virginia for years, they even have an organization online that believed that the mountain lion was extinct since the 1900s that we caused it. But I said, there's no way in the heck. I never did believe that. I said, animals travel. We're more and more here building homes, subdivisions of homes that are pushing the wildlife out. And so anything that's out west might be pushing toward east. And eventually it's going to travel over to somewhere else. So I'm pretty sure we have mountain lions here. We just, got a good enough pictures. Well, there's a couple of them I read a few years later after I wrote that in Haunted Virginia. It came out the same these might really be real mountain lions that were seen, not wildcats. I was thinking you can tell the difference between a wildcat and a mountain lion, that long tail to begin with. It's not a bobcat. And the way it is, and it's much bigger. There were two of them. They finally admitted that. That's like anything else. Things travel. They got coyotes here they never had before. A lot of them, because they're moving, traveling. Got to find a place to live when you don't have your place to live anymore. So that could be another reason for sometimes the stories. I got some of them in there, like dogmen seen in some cities, because it's the same thing with we're pushing the woods out. And so... who knows what's coming to us? Maybe more than just the bears and that. So
yeah, I'm never surprised by the arrogance of officialdom. Sometimes I remember speaking to David Weatherly, and they were talking about panthers and cougars in Georgia, and it was the same thing there, Pamela. Oh no, they don't come here. And they said, well, we know that they've got panthers in Florida. And the official said, well, they're not going to cross the border, are they? As if a cat.
No, they're not.
As if a cat's going to go, oh, no, I'm not going to Georgia.
Just like Bigfoot, and I'm sure Dogman, they travel too, you know? It's not like they're going to stay in one state. Like anything else, I mean. Got to look for better pastures, right?
Yeah, yeah. Have you had anybody contact you since the book's come out with their own personal stories, Pamela?
Seller of mine, a bookseller at Fredericksburg Barnes & Noble, when I did the first signing there, she came up to me and she said she bought the book and she loves it. When she was in Germany, her family, I don't know if it was her husband's in the military or whatever, over there near the Black Forest, that area, they're near far from the town that has a statue, a memorial to a werewolf sighting in the medieval times.
Mm-hmm.
And she mentioned that, and I forgot to see if I can have that information somewhere that I could have looked it up again, because I did look it up when she asked me to. One night she says she was sitting on the porch of her house. It was dark. Okay. There is no wolves in Germany. They're basically gone there, so they don't have wolves. Okay. They're not being reintroduced like we are having them here. And so her and a neighbor, all of a sudden, she started hearing a howl. And it was a wolfish howl. I mean, dog howl, you know, it's not no anything else that you can't deny what it is. And so it kept coming real loud. And she tells her neighbor, what, hear that? She goes, her neighbor says, get in the house, lock the door, don't come out till morning. Don't worry. But get in the house, lock the door, just get in there. And she said that she listened, finally went in there and locked it till morning. So she believes she heard a real, and says, she's wondering she didn't see either like a werewolf or a dogman, because they're not far down from that town that had that memorial in Germany. And there is no wolves in Germany, so she knows it was not a wolf. This was in the forest that they were by. So, yeah, she told me that. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it is very interesting. And as we've just been saying about animals moving, I know, because obviously the vast majority of Europe, the wolf is a protected species now. And it's started over the last sort of 3 or 4 years over here, Pamela, that you're seeing more and more stories. They are expanding rapidly in Italy. I think it was last year that a family who went to a playground in the Netherlands stumbled across a wolf just wandering about, which they were like, what's going on here? Because I don't think they'd seen a wolf in the Netherlands for nearly 200 years. So, you know, the wolf population was supposed to be on the eastern flanks of Western Europe. You know, you've got some in France, and I know, as you were saying, about there are some reports of them skirting through Germany and Austria especially. So it shows you just how adaptable animals can be, that we just presume, oh, they'll not do that. But if you protect them, they bounce back rapidly.
Yeah, and there's only five, I think I looked it up, five types of wolves in the world. So there is five types. One of them I know is the one that they actually thought it was a werewolf at one point in South America. But there is a wolf that looks more like a fox, but a very long, tall fox.
Yes.
I've seen it. It looks very odd.
Yes. Is it the long-maned wolf? It looks like a fox on stilts.
Yeah. So there is five types of wolves. So I think we're starting to reinduce, because you need our predators. If you don't have predators, eventually it's why certain places may have problems with the prey eating, maybe the deer eating more and stuff like that. Mm. I know here we have people fighting it with the, like out west, the timber wolf they're reinducing in a couple of the parks, and because they got ranchers near there. But you know what? You know, they worry about their cattle. Well, same thing with a mountain lion. A mountain lion could have got them, too. They live in that park, too. So
yeah.
They're really worried. Put up a fence with the electric fence. It'll keep the wolves out and the cattle in.
Yeah.
But, you know, animals, that's just, you know, we have to reinduce them.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's only so much you can do. The animals, you need predators. You need prey. And it's pretty logical.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you only have to look at the positive impact it's had in Yellowstone, as you say, because the deer there were just completely decimating the plant population. Yeah. They've introduced the wolves. All the plants have come back, which just shows you, because the deers now know they can't just sit around for days grazing. They've got to keep moving.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a wonderful collection. It's a real compendium of all kinds of accounts. There are stories I've never heard of. You'll be amazed of which towns don't have a wolf or a dogman story in North America, it would seem, by looking at some of them. There are fascinating ones, there are amusing ones, there are scary ones. It's a great collection of anecdotes and stories and newspaper accounts over the years, Pamela. So what's next for you after this? Are you returning to the paranormal, or has this given you a thirst for more cryptid books?
Well, I'm writing fiction now. I just had a children's picture book come out about fairies and Christmas. In fact, the illustrator they hired actually is from my same area. She lives in Richmond part, though. So she's the illustrator of the fairies in it and the Christmas. The next thing I have coming out, at least, is fiction. I have a YA coming out next year called A Demon Possessed Girl. It's a YA dark fantasy. From the same publisher, but I also have a couple of anthologies coming out next year. One is in January, and it's a poem I had that actually, because I'm with the Horror Writer Association, I had it, because at that point, the poem I had written for it, the publisher had closed, they hadn't done anything more, so I thought, well, submit it, and it got into their Horror Writer Association's Poetry Showcase, number 7. Well, he contacted me, he's now editor at Cemetery Dance, so Terror at Miskatonic Falls is coming back out, and my poem's back in. I'll be paid for it, and it's a big pro one, so that's January. And then I got one in March coming out called Haunted Zone, which is published by a editor, publisher who is owned by she was a former Marine. She got a bunch of different female women, more veterans like me. I was in the Army and that, and we wrote stories and poetry. I have a poem and a story in it. So that's coming out. That's the first of its kind. So.
Fabulous. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, I look forward to anything you've got coming down the pipe. So where can everybody follow your work, keep up to date with everything, and find your website, Pamela?
Okay, my website's real easy. Pamela K. Kinney. That's PamelaKKI. NNEY.com, or they can probably go to Amazon. There's an Amazon page. You just look up that name, or because there's most of the books, not all of them, but most will be on there too, because they're all over. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram. I'm there. And I'm writing, and I will keep writing. I'm actually working on a horror novel right now, over edits on it. It's kind of taking a basic old myth of something and change and adding it to this frightening ghost story of people been disappearing for hundreds of years on this land. So
brilliant. Well, Pamela, thank you so much for your time. As I said, it's a brilliant book for anybody who loves stories and myths and legends. This is a fabulous collection of all of them, chock full of interesting stories from all around North America and beyond. And I just want to say thank you again for your time and your conversation. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me too. It's been a pleasure.